One, two.
This is Culturetopia, a look at all things cultural from your friends at National Public Radio. I'm Neda Ulubi, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Sonaran Glenton, producer for NPR's All Things Considered. Neda, we can find all the stories in this podcast in their entirety and subscribe to the podcast at our website. It's brand new, npr.org/culturetopia.
That's right, Sonari.
And Neda, I'm also told you can fill us in on what we'll hear this week.
Correct again. This week we've got stories about Ray Bradbury's classic Fahrenheit 451 as a graphic novel, a writer who tells stories on postcards, Italian hip-hop, actor Eric Bana, and we'll find out just what makes things funny. But first up,
Chester Himes. He was an African-American writer who would have turned 100 years old last week. He was many things, but mostly he was a writer of crime novels. NPR commentator John Ridley tells us a little bit more about Chester Himes in this essay.
You know what I've got in my collection of rare pulp fiction? A 1969 printing of Chester Himes' Run, Man, Run. The jacket copy is simultaneously to the point and over the top. Quote, lush sex and stark violence, colored black, served up raw by a great Negro writer. If one were to crank out a micro summary of Chester Himes' work, that would pretty much be it. Himes, who would have turned 100 today, fairly personified the grit and grandeur of the hard-boiled life. As a teen in Cleveland, he lost his virginity to what he described as an old, fat, ugly whore. As a young man, he's kicked out of Ohio State University, eventually nicked for armed robbery, and sentenced to 25 years hard labor. But once inside, Himes bides his time writing short stories and is eventually published in Esquire using his prison number as his pen name, 59623. In 1945, Himes' novel, If He Hollers, Let Him Go, is published, the first in a vein of what some contemporaries would deride as a protest novel. And they were. Himes never soft-pedaled his disdain for the systemic racism of the day or for black integrationists, whom he referred to as whining beggars. Fed up with race politics, Himes eventually ditched America for Paris, and in 1955 abandoned the protest novel to begin a new series of books, The Harlem Cycle. Starting with For Love of Imabel in 1957 and ending with Blind Man with a Pistol in 1969, the eight-novel series would not only be Himes' most enduring work, but some of the most powerful American fiction ever written. With NYPD detectives Coffin Ed Johnson and Gravedigger Jones as protagonists, readers of the series were given a tour of New York's Harlem that didn't patronize and didn't flinch. I put the slang, the daily routine, the complex human relationships of Harlem into my detective novels, Himes once said. He took what was previously a quote-unquote exotic place in people and made them real. It's why Himes preferred to call his books domestic novels rather than detective fiction. Some have glibly referred to Himes as the Jackie Robinson of noir fiction. Not hardly true. Despite the fact that Himes went on to receive France's highest award for crime fiction, his success opened few doors. Hard-boiled fiction has largely remained the domain of a particular kind of writer. 100 years after his birth, for better and for worse, the great Chester Himes remains nearly one of a kind.
Another writer, another story, another interview. Fahrenheit 451 was written by Ray Bradbury and published in 1953. Artist Tim Hamilton has produced a graphic novel adaptation of Bradbury's classic and even got his approval for the new storytelling. Hamilton told NPR's Lynn Neary that Bradbury did not exactly collaborate, but he did offer a sense of what the book is about.
He wanted the book to be the future as seen through the eyes of the 50s, and I agreed that it shouldn't look like a bizarre future that you wouldn't recognize, because I feel Fahrenheit is kind of a fable for any time.
Hamilton says figuring out what worked best visually and what had to be cut was like a puzzle.
I sat at home or sat at a coffee shop reading the book numerous times and finding out the parts that you have to take out. As I'm sure you've seen movies made out of your favorite book, you know they have to leave out some parts in order to condense it to 2 hours. I actually don't like doing that. It's a conflicting feeling within me, but I can take these visual scenes and illustrate them.
Apart from the images, Hamilton manages to retain much of the power of Bradbury's original words, and even includes verbatim one passage that explains how things came to be in this future world, and notes that while books are banned, comic books are not.
Books, so the damned snobbish critics said, were dishwater. No wonder books stopped selling. The public, knowing what it wanted, let the comic book survive. and the three-dimensional sex magazines, of course. There you have it, Montauk. It didn't come from the government down. There was no dictum, no declaration. Technology, mass exploitation, and minority pressure carried the trick.
That story lives in its entirety on our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
So we're on a roll with writers on this podcast. Next is a story about writer Michael Hamilton. He lives in Baltimore, and on a dare, he once wrote his life story on the back of a postcard. His life was covered in 600 words, and he says it was a thrilling experience. And now he's doing the same for others, for free, on his blog. NPR's Madeline Brand reads from one of those cards and asks Hamilton about it.
Gina Mowish's father went to prison before she really knew him. Gina remembers going to random houses with her mother to buy drugs, and then her mother went to a mental hospital to be treated for schizophrenia, anorexia, and drug abuse. When her mother wasn't in the mental hospital, she was fighting with her boyfriend. There was always fighting around her. That must have been a difficult postcard to write.
To that point, that was the most difficult postcard I had ever tried to write. And there was so much story there for a very young person. And so I struggled with a couple of things. One, trying to honor the difficulty of her life and still include all of those details, because that was something that was very important to her, to get all of that story out there. Mm-hmm. The other part was presenting the material in an even-handed way. To not make it sentimental, but also to not sensationalize it.
There's much more to this interview and a link to Michael Hamilton's blog at our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
Yo penso positivo perché son vivo, perché son vivo. Yo penso positivo perché son vivo e perché son vivo.
Now that this is my first time guest hosting Culturetopia, but I know enough to know that this is not our theme music. So what are we listening to?
That, Mio Bello, is Italy's most influential pop star. Like all great pop stars, he goes by one name, Jovanotti. And NPR's Guy Raz caught up with the singer during a month-long swing through New York clubs. He asked Jovanotti why he made the trek to New York.
I came here when I had the chance to spend some time, you know, and to develop also a sort of relationship, you know, with the small audience that I could imagine to have here. And so it was for me like a sort of laboratory, you know, it was a sort of workshop that I wanted to do, to get back to the roots of my job, you know. I am a musician, I like to do music. And music starts from a small room, you know, when crowds of people that want to have fun and feel deep emotions, you know.
Let's hear a little bit from one of those more intimate concerts you had. This is from Joe's Pub, a club in New York, and the track you're singing here is called Tanto, Tanto, Tanto.
Lo sa che le apparenze non ingannano, i cigni dentro l'acqua non si bagnano. Lo sa che c'è una febbre che ti fa guarire e che ci sta un silenzio che si fa sentire. Lo sa che il DNA è lungo più dell'equatore. Lo sa che c'è uno spirito anche dentro d'un motore.
And let me read the English translations of what you're singing here. There's a fever that can cure you. There's a silence that can make you hear. DNA is longer than the equator. There's a spirit even inside of a motor. Italian hip hop.
I never listened to my live gigs here, you know. It's great. I like it, yeah.
Well, was it strange performing hip-hop music in the city where hip-hop was born, in New York City?
It was a big thing, you know. I discovered music, and maybe I discovered also to be a human being through hip-hop, you know, when I was a small boy, you know, and I listened to this music coming from here, you know, Afrika Bambaataa, the Zulu Nation, you know, Grandmaster Flash. For me, it was like a sort of musical epiphany, you know. Coming here to play, you know, it's like, I always say, it's like for an American priest to go to the Vatican.
To the Vatican.
You know? Yeah, it's something like that, you know. You go to the Vatican and you discover, you know, where everything started. You know?
Le zebre sono bianche con le strisce nere. Le zebre sono nere con le strisce bianche. Lo sai che per le mosche noi siamo lentissimi e per una balena siamo piccolissimi. L'Africa è il continente più ricco del pianeta. A volte l'alfabeto inizia dalla Z.
Pavarotti, Sinatra, Jovanotti.
Why not?
One of the many gifts that Italy has given us.
We're going to slip in a little bit of summer songs in our podcast.
All Things Considered has been running a series during the summer, asking various people, artists, musicians, about their favorite summer songs. And we've gotten some surprises. This week, Melissa Block talked to Adam Duritz, who's the founder and lead singer of The Counting Crows.
I picked Save It For Later by The English Beat, or The Beat.
Save It For Later from 1982 and The English Beat's album Special Beat Service. The English Beat started in Birmingham, England. They fused pop, reggae, punk, and ska. Adam Duritz of Counting Crows had just graduated from high school in Berkeley, California in 1982 when the song came out. The English Beat came to play at Berkeley's outdoor amphitheater, the Greek Theater, that summer, and Adam Duritz camped out all night to make sure he'd get a spot right up front.
Because the first like two or three rows were open. If you got there early enough, you could get those rows. And we'd camp out there and then just go see the show.
What is it about this one song, Save It For Later, that for you clicks when you think of favorite summer song?
You know, I was trying to look at the lyrics to see what it was, and I don't know. There's just something about the joy of the song. Like, it just seems so technicolor to me. The harmonies, the melodies are perfect. There's so many interesting sounds going on. And I think that day, you know, just it's just so engraved in my memory of just this beautiful sunny summer day and watching these bands play all day and the sun having gone down. So that means the lights and the colors from the stage were lighting up as they came to play. And then the weird realization right afterwards that was it. That was the end of the band. That was the last show they ever played. Those feelings that you don't get to hold on to, those memories of a time, of a moment when you just felt good. Something about the music just completely infused you with this, the celebration of it, you know, of being able to play it. I know what that's like on stage sometimes, just that feeling of like, I can't possibly express in what I'm about to sing how great it feels to sing it. It's the only song I can remember from the day. It's funny because I'm picturing it in the sunshine and I'm sure they were playing at night.
Yeah, but you see sunshine.
But like it just seems like this crystalline perfect summer day and I'm just euphoric. And this song is just shimmering.
Well, Adam Duritz, it's fun to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And have a great summer.
And you should all go listen to that record, Special Beat Service.
You know, somewhere in my basement, I still have that LP in a box.
It's a great record.
It's a great record.
You know, now that when you produce stuff, sometimes there are these little surprises that stick in your head or these things that you hear that stick in your head, and the word shimmers has been in my head all week. And Melissa and I have talked about it a lot, that, you know, we'll be walking through past each other and we'll be like, you know what? That interview just shimmered.
Well, it was a shimmering production, too.
Well, thank you. Well, Netta, actor Eric Bana is in two new movies this summer, the comedy Funny People and the drama The Time Traveler's Wife. He was on NPR's Fresh Air to talk about his career and how he managed to master various dialects.
You're Australian, but, you know, you often do movies as people from other countries, and you have to use accents, like an Israeli accent in Munich, an American accent in some of your American films. I guess, was it hard to get the Israeli accent?
It wasn't. It wasn't. At first, I was like, how the hell am I going to do this? Then the more I studied it, and I have a wonderful coach that I work with, Susan Hegarty, who is great at research and had sent me a lot of materials. And fortunately for me, when the film was in pre-production, it got pushed and we sort of went 12 months later. And so kind of like with Chopper, a similar thing happened. You just end up with about a year's a year's more prep than you thought you were going to get. So you just use that time. So I sat with the Israeli accent for a very, very long time. It wasn't like an accelerated preparation. I probably in the end had a good 18 months to at least to get up to speed with it. And, you know, my parents are of European background. My father is Croatian, my mother's German, and it's not completely similar to them in sounds, but I think having an ear for European sounds, I think, definitely helps.
You know, Americans don't think of themselves as having an accent. We think of ourselves as being like the default setting, and, you know, British people have accents, Australian people have accents, but we don't. You know, so when you hear like American speech, what do you consider some of the defining characteristics?
See, I think you speak very well. I mean, I think there's two kinds of American speakers as well as there's two kinds of Australian speakers. I mean, Australians can speak very lazily, you know, and just kind of, you know, not really articulate things and have a very lazy mouth. And Americans can do the same thing where they, like, talk through their nose and, like, sort of, like, whine a little bit and all that kind of thing. But then there's that very articulate version, you know, the opposite version of both, which is very sort of succinct and clipped. And so I guess you're sort of always paying attention to those things. It does get easier over time. Obviously, I find it a lot easier now doing an American accent than I did 10 years ago. It's, you sort of get more and more practice in each film when you're sitting down with your coach. You've got, you know, a different level of reference points and stuff to go on.
Okay, Sonori, I have a funny question. What's the secret to comedy?
Timing.
NPR Scott Simon asked the same thing of writer-director Harold Ramis, and the reply was pretty hilarious and a damn good example of just what makes good comedy. Ramis was one of the comedy writers interviewed by author Mike Sachs for his book, And Here's the Kicker, Conversations with 21 Top Humor Writers on Their Craft. Another of the writers he interviewed was Buck Henry, who wrote this iconic scene from The Graduate.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
I've said. That's a deal.
The classic line, among so many, I guess we should say, from The Graduate, plastics, sounds like it could have been almost anything else.
It could have been, but the reason he used the word plastics is because a college professor of his used to use it all the time. And he was thinking back on his college years and remembered that and just put it in. He said he had no idea it would become such an iconic line.
Why is plastics funny and, say, nylon isn't, or stocks and bonds isn't?
You want to answer that, Harold?
I've sat in rooms with well-paid comedy writers trying to think of the funniest candy bar name. Or the funniest soft drink, you know. There's a moment in Caddyshack where Ted Knight offers Danny the caddy, how about a Fresca? Fresca is funnier than Coke. It's funnier than 7-Up or Pepsi, you know.
And is you who too funny? Or too obvious?
You who's trying too hard. Yeah. But, you know, we make these judgments, and grown people, educated people, have long debates about these things. And I'm sure plastics just sounds funnier.
We asked people for some questions for the both of you. May I share them with you?
Yes.
John B. Thomas asks, what's the funniest clean word in the English language?
Oh, boy. You got one?
I'm thinking. I have some blue ones, but not a clean one.
The funniest clean word. Wow, that's tough. I'd need a panel of comedy writers, and we'd have to pay them a lot. I could probably find that out for $1,000.
Well, I mean, for example, is Hoboken funny because it's Hoboken, or because
it's got a K in it? You know, yeah. There's that thing about K's from Sunshine Boys.
Right.
K's are funny. Hoboken. Plastics has a K sound. Fresca.
Sax.
Kangaroo.
Kangaroo.
That's, I think, the funniest zoo animal.
Rodney Dangerfield improvised the line in Caddyshack. There's a gopher that's plaguing the golf course. And at one point, a gopher puppet steals Rodney's golf ball. And Rodney improvises, hey, that kangaroo just stole my ball. But calling a small rodent a kangaroo is hysterical to me.
Well, maybe we don't know how to make it, but we know it when we see it. Comedy. That is.
Well, we better leave it at that for the week.
I'm Netta Ulavi. Sonari, it was great to have you on this week.
Thank you so much, Netta. I'm Sonari Glenton, and it was great to be here.
We'll give you the last word.
You can find links to all the stories we've heard today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Thanks for listening.